If we look closely at changing political systems and economies, we can actually perceive patterns that can help us better understand what's happening in the world. I'm Susan McGinnis for Conversations. I hope you'll join me as we talk with Dr. Charles Lindbloom, Professor of Politics and Economics at Yale University. Dr. Lindbloom, welcome and thanks for joining us. I want to take you first to changes that have been happening in the former USSR, the Commonwealth of Independent States, and to Eastern Europe. You have said that those changes are an indication of more than popular frustration or of what we would think of as an authoritarian government falling of its own weight, but that something is happening that indicates a shift from centralization to decentralization in politics and economics. Can you look briefly at that and tell us what's happening there?
Big order.
Take a part of it.
I think that all over the world there is and has been for hundreds of years, a continuing struggle between the practice of highly centralized methods of managing a society and much more decentralized methods of managing a society, and that this is another chapter in that long book. In that sense, there's more going on there than the appearance of the immediate situation would suggest. By the conflict between centralization and decentralization, I mean a very big difference in practice, with the market system being the example of the most highly decentralized method of social organization that man's ever devised or stumbled into, and a highly authoritarian state as an example of the most centralized. When I say the market's decentralized, I mean it's a system of organizing the cooperative activities of people all over the world for production without any central, without much central management, without any single world manager of the world market system, but with important decisions in the hands of millions and millions of entrepreneurs.
Nobody runs it, it runs itself.
People run it, but no centralist runs it. Everybody runs it. That is, millions of people, by their decisions to buy or sell or start a new business or curb production, they're running the system. They don't know it, or they don't ordinarily see themselves as running it. They simply see themselves as getting the week's groceries or making another buck by a clever business deal, but it's their activities and their little decisions that make the whole system go.
Is there an analog in politics in terms of decentralization?
There's nothing so extreme in politics as the extremes of decentralization reached in a market system. But yes, there are analogs. That is, you have, for example, in the British parliamentary system, a high degree of central authority, not complete, but compared to the American system, a high degree of central authority in the hands of a prime minister, and a parliament that is greatly reduced in any independent authority. Even its traditional power to remove the prime minister is not a very strong one. Whereas in the United States, you have constant negotiation and bargaining between congressional leaders and the president, as well as a large amount of congressional negotiation among congressional leaders and between the House and the Senate. So compared to the British system, ours is a much more decentralized political system.
But there's no situation where hundreds of thousands of political entrepreneurs run the democracy.
Not as there is in a market system, no.
Do you think that's in our future? I want to ask you more about that later, but I'm curious right now.
Would it be a good idea if we do more of that?
How participatory a democracy can we create?
Well, you can't go as far as in the market, because what we factor out in this market style of decentralization is the power to undertake what are, on the whole, non-coercive activities, that is, production of this and that. And for that purpose, you can afford to trust an entrepreneur to start another firm. But since the powers of the state are powers to coerce, not always, but in very large part, you can't assign the power to coerce to for millions and millions of people in the system. It'd be a dreadful society.
Give me a quick example of powers of coerce. I think people pretty much can grasp that. But
well, you can't
concrete.
Have independent policemen. The police have got to be locked into a centrally managed policing system.
Otherwise, it's a vigilante system.
Right. You can't have the army fragmented into a group of guerrilla groups warring with each other from coast to coast.
Although it happens, clearly, in other countries.
Then you call that breakdown, chaos. Civil war. It's an intolerable situation.
This is Conversations. Our guest today is Dr. Charles Lindbloom. We're talking about changes in politics and in the economy, but in systematic terms. We'll be talking today about centralization and decentralization, how both of them work, and how we move away and towards each. I'm Susan McGinnis. My guest today, Dr. Charles Lindbloom, is the Sterling Professor of Economics and Political Science Emeritus at Yale University. He's been with Yale since 1946. This is Conversations. Another trend you noted in a recent lecture was that while Eastern countries seem to be moving both politically and economically away from centralization,
yes.
In America, we seem to be decentralizing the marketplace at a rapid rate, but moving towards centralization in our government form. Can we look at the latter first?
Yes.
That's a different trend
yes.
for us. What's happening?
Well, decentralization we usually see in American democratic politics as we label it with this well-known name, pluralism. We talk about a pluralistic system in which everybody hypothetically gets into the act. Decisions aren't made by a president or even by a clear-cut congressional majority, but made by an adjustment and negotiation and mutual manipulation of interest group leaders and people in the bureaucracy and people in the White House and people close to the president and congressional leaders.
And the courts.
It's a big, confused process. Some people see it all as ugly and untidy rather than highly rational, but it has been the basic system that we have operated on. It is highly diverse and we say highly pluralistic. Now, it's that is taking the blame these days for widespread frustration that American people feel, both academic and ordinary people in the street, about the inability of the American government to cope with its problems. You know, increasingly, you must be hearing it. We hear it everywhere.
Great
government
luck.
Can't cope with environmental problems. Government can't cope with urban crime problems, make the street safe. Our kids aren't being properly educated. Crime rampant, corruption in government seems to be more conspicuous than it's been for many, many decades. And when people look around and ask for an explanation of why everything is going wrong in the government's ability to act, why it seems more paralyzed than energetic, muscular, and brainy, they say, too much pluralism, too much of this fragmentation of power to many different places. Whereas on the market side, you see, we rejoice in the degree to which that kind of fragmentation makes the economy full of growth and innovation, efficiency. On the democratic political side, we worry about its excesses.
Now, this
not inconsistent to believe both that market decentralization is doing a pretty good job and to believe that decentralization in government is gone to extremes that are not productive.
That was my question. Why is it not inconsistent?
Everything in its place is the simplest answer.
Okay.
I can give you a long-winded answer, but maybe that's enough.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll get back to it with another question. Now, you have also said that we have, especially in politics, an urging towards centralization historically. We tend to, I assume, feel safer under centralization. Is that true, and do you think that's why people are criticizing so the decentralized practices of our government now?
Yes, that's not the whole story, but that's a large part of it. I think that many of our incapacities that people are so deeply frustrated over are not in fact properly attributable to pluralism, as I said, they were being attributed to pluralism.
Right.
I think that we have never had a popular or even a very profound academic and theoretical understanding of the efficacy of pluralism. We have been more aware of its defects, which are significant in the way we have designed pluralist institutions. They're not well designed. But there are other reasons why we have a passion for centralization. It seems, at least on the surface, so much more orderly. The idea that a central committee, a planning bureau, a research team, a cabinet, or a president, or a group of congressional leaders can think through, work out a problem, see it in its many aspects, and put a solution in place, that seems much, much more plausible to most of our minds than that a solution could emerge through some kind of interaction in a highly decentralized system. Now, we've got the evidence that the most extremely decentralized system for large-scale social organization in the world, the market, does work. Even so, we just can't quite bring ourselves to believe that decentralization, even in the modest way in which it can be practiced in political life, is as safe and secure and as orderly and productive as good centralization. It's a very deep-seated bias, I think. And it's seconded or reinforced by hundreds of years of attempts of dominant, advantaged elitist groups in a society to try to keep a potentially subversive and unruly population in line by continuing to assert the desirability, even the necessity, of order from the top. In other words, centrally imposed and designed order. You get that, you know, in Hobbes, and you get it in, you might say, more opportunistic and crass views of elites at any time in history.
That the elites should rule by their very elitism, their intelligence.
Masses are dangerous.
Yeah.
Hamilton was terrified of mass power.
And does this come down to what we believe about human nature? Human beings can govern themselves. Human beings are more base than that, need to be governed.
We say, does this come down? I think the elitist attempt to sell us on the virtues of centralization,
yes,
for fear of mass disorder and subversion, that's not human nature. That's a deliberately designed, even sometimes you might say conspiratorial, invention to keep masses,
so it's
masses of citizens, docile and accept the inevitability of the continuation of their problems instead of the inevitability of some solutions or ameliorations.
So it's not so high-minded as an overarching belief about human nature or its potential.
No, I don't deny that exists too. An overriding belief, but I ask, where does that overriding belief come from? It's not human nature that gives us an overriding belief in that dismal view of human nature. It's a long history of contestation between attempts of masses of people to break in on the monopoly of authority and prestige and income and wealth held in the hands of elites, and the defense, on the other hand, of elites of those privileges, advantages.
Once again, this is Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis, our guest. Charles Lindbloom has published many books, the most recent of which is an award-winning book called Inquiry and Change, subtitled The Troubled Attempt to Understand and Shape Society. Yale University Press published it in 1990. It has taken at least two awards to date. I don't think it will be a divergence at this point to ask you to talk to us about how language emerged in a decentralized way. We've taken a look at how the elites would like to keep a centralized authority, and yet there are very good examples, you have said, besides the market economy, that show how things work very well in a decentralized way, language being one of them. Can you give us a short course?
One of my favorite examples, for anyone who really can't understand how you could ever get order and system in the absence of a central design or central management, language creation is just a marvelous example, because what we have in fact done in groups of millions of people is get an agreement within those millions that these sounds and these symbols are going to mean this. Now it's a feat of social organization. Most people wouldn't think of language that way, but consider it. It's a feat of social organization to get millions of people to agree to use the same symbols and the same sounds in the same way. So that when you use a symbol, I know what you're trying to say, and when you use a sound, I know what you're trying to say. That's a feat of social organization.
And nobody told us to do
it. Nobody ever designed this. No central mind ever created these languages, English, French, Swahili, any of these. None have been designed by a central committee. They have all grown up as remarkable feats of social organization out of interactions between millions and millions of, you might say, decentralized decision makers. Each one of those decentralized decision makers, you being one, I being one, making a decision, this is how he is going to use the sound and the symbol in the light of what he's been hearing around him as to how people use. And it isn't that we have all simply fallen into habits of agreeing on a unchanging set of sounds and symbols. Notice languages go on changing. The American, the English vocabulary, you know, grows at a tremendous rate, and there are new grammatical structures that get created, particularly in our time, very much abbreviated grammatical structures for saying things very pithily, quickly, with very few words. So this process of creation goes on, but notice it's not a process in which you create your own private diversion from English and I create another one so that after a few years we can't even talk to each other. It's a process of creation which you and I coordinate all the time. We continue to work, continue to explore possibilities of new common symbols, new common sounds. Marvelous process.
Now, language took a long time to create and seems to change slowly in time, although in our time, language, like everything else, may be changing more quickly. People might say to you,
it's changing so fast, incidentally, though it's still slow by other standards, that I, at my age, can't understand the language at the margin of some young people. They have bought into a new set of terms that leave me baffled sometimes. Go ahead, though.
Okay. In talking about the rate of change, though, one would say that language has emerged, evolved, and coordinated itself over eons and eons. Some would say that's an argument, Dr. Lynn Bloom, that the process of decentralized change is too slow. It's sluggish. If we tried to actually affect society through decentralized change, we couldn't do that. Is there an example that shows us that that statement's not true?
Lots of them.
Pick your favorite one.
Well, one is, take any sports team, take a basketball team. You can lay down some central rules to the players that define generally the strategies they are to follow. And that's done by a coach, let's say. But once the game starts, the game is like a game of checkers, at any point unique. It isn't, the game has never quite looked exactly like that. And what every player has to do in order to achieve the team cooperation, they'll get the ball down, let's say, to the basket and get it in, is something that cannot be centrally masterminded. It's the attempt to communicate centrally, central direction, to form the central direction and communicate to the player, It's preposterous, laughable. The only way these players can coordinate themselves well enough to get the ball down and into the basket is by adjusting to each other. In other words, each one has to act as a sensitive, watchful, fast-thinking decision maker and coordinate, above all, coordinate. See, it isn't a matter of it's everyone going alone in a basketball team or any other kind of team. So here we have high speed, furiously rapid coordination process. And in that case, any attempt to centrally coordinate those players, laughable, it would be just hopelessly slow and sluggish, rigid, and unable to deal with the ever-emerging new unique situation.
In some ways, is the basketball game an analog to the slightly slower-moving marketplace?
Yeah.
Everybody pays attention, coordinates, looks at signals. Oops, can't sell it for that much. I'm making too many. We've got to distribute over here.
Yes, okay. Very much so.
Okay. Now, that, I think, helps us understand a little bit more about how centralization works and how decentralization works. Why are these two concepts important? Why do we care? You've called them fundamental to decision-making, socially and economically. Why is that true?
Well, one example. Soviet communist Marxist theory since the Russian Revolution in 1917, this theory simply denigrated the possibility, really more ignored it, overlooked it, but to some extent specifically denigrated it when the theory of decentralization was associated with the market, and asserted that, in effect, the only rational way to organize a society, hence the only rational way for Lenin to proceed, and subsequently Stalin, was with a high degree of central management. They later came to conclude that the degree of central management that they had been attempting was not worth perpetuating. That's what they have finally come to. It didn't work. They found it not only inefficient in that the economy didn't grow at the rate that these more decentralized economies were growing, but they found increasingly they had to admit there were humane factors, coercion and brutalities and stifling of individual opportunity, development, thought. So that on all counts, not we as critics said it wasn't working, but they as practitioners of it said it wasn't working. So they now look back on years and years of unnecessary hardship, years and years of lost opportunities. Perhaps in the very early years when the economy was very simple, they would still argue that centralization worked for the purposes of dragooning agricultural production into the cities to start the urban industrial process. But except for those early years where it's controversial, their testimony has been, we have been through a period of waste and lost opportunity, a terrible tragedy. That's why it matters that we understand what we can do with centralization, what we can do with decentralization. Now, the mistakes in policy in the Western world, I think, are much less serious than those, but you asked me for an example of why it matters. There's mm-hmm. Colossal example of why it matters. Misery is the answer if you make bad enough choice between centralization and decentralization.
Is the urging of our government, the self-urging of our government towards centralization, a concern to you in that light?
Yes. For example, in the years in which the industrialized nations of the world entered in to foreign aid to develop the third world. All these industrialized nations of the West, acting independently or sometimes through World Bank Consortium programs like that, were convinced that the way in which these underdeveloped countries were going to get ahead fast was to develop centrally masterminded central development plans. Mm-hmm. And we required then in the World Bank, bastion, you might think, of free market methods of social organization. We required in the World Bank and in the American aid program and German and English, Canadian aid programs, that these third world countries, as a condition of getting grants or loans for economic development, produce centrally masterminded plans and try to live up to them.
Show us their five-year plan.
Yeah. Right. Now, we have retired from that slowly and disillusioned and said planning of a incremental, piecemeal, selective sort makes sense, but even we, as the ideological defenders of the free market, were compelling third world countries to attempt feats of central masterminding their economic development that they were incapable of. So there's another example of why it matters, and here it mattered to American policy because we were wasting our foreign aid resources in the pursuit of that will-o'-the-wisp. It was our government that was taking much of the lead in imposing this rigid demand on these third world countries. Now we still have the continuing problem. We've had in the Reagan administration, the Bush administration, attempt to move toward more extreme forms of decentralization even than we had before, decentralized as the market was. As you know, they wanted to put some governmental functions back into the decentralized market arena. I don't think that the choice between the degree of marketization or demarketization of the economy that are open in the United States now and which have been raised to an issue of debate by the Reagan administration in particular offer us catastrophe if we make the wrong choice, as the choice eventually produced catastrophe in the Soviet Union. But still, there are some big issues there. And one of the big issues is our position in international trade. As you know, there's a great deal of anxiety about the relatively poor performance of the U.S. compared especially to Japan in the international market economy. And here we've got a debate, quite an inconclusive one, but a most interesting one. Should the United States gamble on traditional forms of extreme market decentralization, you know, business as usual, free enterprise, sort of an international laissez-faire, and hope to compete effectively with Japan, Germany, other countries of the world?
At risk that we may be put out of the market.
Right. Or should we use a degree of central planning,
coercion,
central masterminding of a strategy for deciding to encourage, say, this group of industries in international trade and take our, and not encourage this group, never develop selectivity and discrimination, which is the Japanese have done. That's a big issue right now, not solved yet, not resolved, still going on, intensely debated in business and academic circles, among economists, people in the business schools, which is the way we should go. The fact that the Japanese have been so successful with the strategy of giving some central direction to international ventures, enormously successful, seems to persuade some Americans that obviously we should do the same thing, but we can't necessarily do it with the skill with which they have done it. And indeed, there are some people who argue that the Japanese just happened to make the right decisions, that they couldn't do it again, and hence we ought to be careful about imitating them.
This is Conversations. My guest today is Dr. Charles Lindbloom from Yale University. He has written extensively on social issues, social problems, politics, and the economy. I'm Susan McGinnis. Once again, this is Conversations. Is there, and this has been a curiosity of mine, is there an option, an opportunity through time for economies, Japanese, American, German, to trade off over time a giving up and taking up of centralized power. That is to say, the Japanese exert for a while, we might pick it up as we were most powerful before we gave it up to the Japanese. The Germans, another powerful economy, might pick up kind of a temporary rule of the world economy. Possible?
If I understand you, the answer is yes. From time to time, these changes can be made. I suspect the Japanese are going to very slowly retire somewhat from their commitment to some degree of centrality in the direction of major investment in foreign trade. That's a kind of a guess, but I see Japan as a very imperfect and relatively low-grade form of political democracy. It's got all the superficial trappings, but you notice the same party wins the election decade after decade. And the degree of genuine democratic feistiness that seems to be necessary for what I'd call a more genuine democracy is very poorly developed in Japan. Now, as that develops, and this democratizing movement seems worldwide, so I do believe it will continue to develop in Japan. As that develops, I think the possibility of central direction of trade in Japan will somewhat decline. So that would be a possibility there. In this country, it may change because the advocates of what we call industrial policy, some degree of central direction of our foreign investments, they may win the debate. Mm. It's going on now. It hasn't been settled. So, yes, the degree to which centrality is attempted in international trade will vary, but don't forget this, and the success of it will vary. It may be much less successful than it was in the Japanese case.
Isn't it also important to remember that both democracies and market economies are very young in terms of systems that have governed economy and populations in the world?
Yes.
And that we're just all experimenting. We're 200 plus years old. Japan's democracy much younger than that.
Yes, and I would stress especially how young democracy is.
Worldwide. We don't really know what we've got in our hands yet.
No, I mean even in the United States.
Yes.
It's a young country and the democratic experiment is fairly young. I like to stress that because the ceiling of democratic aspiration, that is the ceiling of our aspiration for democratizing the political system. No reason to believe that's a low ceiling. No reason to believe we're close to it. I think of American democracy, even Western European democracy, even the highly developed democracies in Scandinavia as not having produced the future to which we are now forever committed, but is still unfolding and developing. There are possibilities for democracy, in other words, that haven't been tapped yet, I think.
One question relative to that. I don't want to lose the market system in this discussion yet, but I am curious. Do you think our government is currently a little too skittish about decentralizing, a little too quick to pull in and say, oh my, we can't just let this power loose among the masses. We've got to hold on to it.
Oh, yes, sure.
Yeah. And partly that's, again, because we're young in terms of democracy, and also partly because of the natural inclination of the elite to hold power onto itself.
Yes.
So both are happening.
Yes.
Okay. I'll take advantage of this break to say that Dr. Charles Lindbloom earned his BA in 1937. It was in economics and in political science from Stanford University. In 1945, his PhD from the University of Chicago. His dissertation was on the subject of unions and capitalism. That is the title of his first book, published by Yale University Press in 1949. We're talking about centralization and decentralization, a couple of abstract concepts that seem to have a lot to do with daily life in this world in which we live. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations. A question about the free marketplace. As this
don't
market,
call it free, just call it the market system. A bundle of freedoms and coercions.
Oh, good. Well, that's where my question lies. A question then about the market system. As we have in the last decade plus removed restrictions from the marketplace, people have become increasingly concerned that the marketplace itself can become chaotic. We seem to have some examples. The SNL crisis may be one. The case of BCCI, the bank that ran amok into drug lords and greed, seems to be another. In another category, concerns about whether the marketplace can be ethical and be responsible for, say, environmental concerns. If the market system becomes, I hesitate to use the word, freer from restrictions, what is to govern it? Is it self-governing as Ronald Reagan said it would be? Or do we need things to govern this system while it is?
Well, it's not. In short, no, it's not self-governing, or at least we wouldn't possibly be satisfied with an attempt to let the market run by itself. We have got to have interventions. We've had them for decades and decades, and the fact that the Reaganites and the Bush administration tried to repeal some of these regulations on the market doesn't deny that the movement to try to protect people from the market when it doesn't work the way we'd like it to is an enormously powerful movement and will presumably continue. But for example, we decided long ago that market motives to employ small children in dangerous kinds of work just intolerable. We couldn't accept the free rein to those motives, and so we passed child labor legislation. And we decided long ago that the degree of income inequality produced by markets was intolerable. And so we inaugurated a constitutional change, income taxation. We simply declare that society has some claims in the interests of masses of people on the incomes of everyone who's relatively productive in the system. And you know, the whole list of these. And we now have a whole new set of problems that we're very slow to wise up to, environmental decay. I think nobody really claims that we can get along without some kind of self-protective regulation steering of the market. The whole dispute is over how much.
How much?
You know, even Bush says he understands the government has to intervene to protect the environment. He doesn't really want it to do much or do anything very effective, but as a principle, he knows it has to be done.
Is that a dance between regulation and freedom that we will just keep doing?
Well, it's a dance between regulation and certain freedoms of certain kinds of people. It's no invasion of my freedom or yours to impose some restrictions on smokestack emissions from an industrial enterprise, though it's an invasion of the freedom of the operator of that facility. That's been an old smokescreen, of course. Well, obfuscation to try to identify market regulation with the loss of, quote, our, unquote, freedom, whereas it represents a loss of freedom to particular functionaries in the system, that is, people who are operating industrial enterprises. Now, we know that we don't believe that people who have particular important grants of authority should have the same freedom to use that authority that ordinary citizens have in living their own lives. So we say, if you make a man president of the United States, he should absolutely not be free to do anything except what the Constitution permits the President of the United States to do. And one of the things the President of the United States can't do, powerful as he is tell me who I should have married when I was of marriageable age, or how to raise my children. I mean, as powerful as the President is, he can claim no particular freedoms. He must accept a wholesale package of coercions on him to limit his functions to the specific performance of his duties. So we never hear the Secretary of Agriculture or the President of the United States or the Chiefs of Staff claiming that because we instruct them as to what they are supposed to do in their functions, that we are intervening or impacting on their freedom adversely. But we have this silly nonsense in which when we try to give instructions to corporate directors as to how they should not pollute the air, they claim we're invading their freedom. You see the analogy, the parallelism. We don't think straight. We accept the notion that an important government official should not be free.
Right.
He should be highly restricted. We don't quite understand that any important functionary in any society that has special obligations, special duties, special powers, similarly cannot claim that instruction as to how he uses those powers invades his freedom.
And when we do that, I mean, I'm using the term we loosely, we shriek that what's happening is that we're being placed under the heavy boot of a centralized state, right?
Yes, that's what these particular we's say, which I'm saying is invalid, yes.
Even when it does seem that regulations arise in a decentralized way, yes?
Yes.
All right. So the shriek is inconsistent with the reality.
I think so,
yeah.
Yes.
All right.
One can understand it. One doesn't have to grant it any validity.
I want to take a look at questions of our democracy and its politics currently. Almost any magazine we pick up, any newspaper, any television public affairs show we watch, tells us that the nation perceives itself to be in gridlock. As you say, we're mm-hmm. not grappling well with environmental mm-hmm. problems. We're not grappling well with our deficit. The budgets of our federal government or of our state governments, mm-hmm. even in some cases of our localities. Mm-hmm. Can you analyze that in terms of our discussion today, centralization and decentralization? Is it possible to do that?
Well, I can show that centralization, decentralization issue is part of the problem. I can't claim that it's the whole problem.
Let's take a look at the parts.
We set up, way back in the Constitutional Convention, a system of decentralization, which I think made sense. I'm talking here about the fact that we gave Congress certain powers and the President certain powers, then we gave them certain powers over each other rather than giving all policymaking powers to the President with, say, the right of Congress to remove him. Rather than that, we said President can take certain acts, Congress, President doesn't like what Congress does, can veto it. If Congress doesn't like what the President does, when he vetoes, they can, if they can get a big enough two-thirds majority, they can override. Then we assigned some problems to the states and said, new federal government has to stay out of these. Then we assigned some problems to the federal government and said states have to stay out of those. Then we assigned some functions to the court, the Supreme Court, and said Congress got to stay out of that. So what we created, you see, was substantial decentralization. Even in the legislative branch, we said, let's have two houses of the legislature instead of one, so that each one will represent a further decentralization of legislative authority. So we ended up with a complex system in which, instead of having a kind of concentrated power in a cabinet, let's say, or prime minister, we diffused this authority. And in the American political development, it was diffused further by the development of parties and the congressional committee system and subcommittees and all that. The original design made a good deal of sense because the designers, though they weren't thinking of the intelligence of decentralized decision making relative to centralized, what they were thinking about was the power, the potential of central authority to overreach, to become too coercive. And they were mindful of the fact that they had been trying to escape through the American Revolution, just such a situation of excessive centralization of power. So they thought what they were doing is designing protection against tyranny. But what they were also doing, you see, is designing a system of decentralized decision making as against a more centralized one, which would have great consequences for the intelligence of policy, not just the tyrannical character of it, which they hoped to control, was going to have implications for the capacity of the nation to deal with its problems. And it's that capacity which we now have no confidence in. Now the question is, was that incapacity, is that incapacity because they made that choice and we have followed that choice? Would we have the capacity if we had a great deal more centralization of authority? Well, we know that extremely centralized forms of authority, as in the Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, have shown even less competence than we have for coping with problems, even for problems like environment, where their record is dreadful. Mm-hmm. We look at slightly more centralized systems, such as the English political system compared to ours, and it hasn't got any better record than we have. So that it looks as though it wasn't the decentralization that was at fault. Nevertheless, as we were saying very early in this talk, a widespread conception is that the problem is excessive decentralization, so extreme that we even use the word fragmentation of authority often to refer to it. President Carter appointed a committee on future of America, which made that very point, that the major obstacle lying in the path of the American government's attempt to cope with its problems competently was excessive fragmentation. So it looks as though maybe there is a case for arguing that decentralization is the problem. Too much decentralization is in the way. And it's possible that that is true. But I would offer a contrary hypothesis. I call your attention again to the fact that what our constitutional forefathers set in motion was a program of a specific form of decentralization. It was a form of decentralization that, fearful of tyranny, put in the hands of dozens of people the possibility of using their decentral authority to say no, to say stop, thou shalt not. Not decentralized authority to do things, but not decentralized sources of initiative, an opportunity to act positively, but decentralized authority to stop what somebody else wanted to do. Thus, the president's veto power isn't to give him capacities to solve a problem, it's to give him a capacity to say, I don't like the congressional solution.
Go back, get me another.
Or the use of two houses in Congress was an attempt, you see, to permit one house to stop the other one from moving. The problem there, by that hypothesis, is that decentralization is not the cause of our present distress, but it's the peculiarity of the form of decentralization which you use, which was a decentralization of the power to stop rather than decentralization of the power to act. Too many dispersed authorities that can say stop to some other one who wants to act. That's maybe a fundamental source of the present lack of confidence in our institutions of government.
So instead of checks and balances as we define our system, we've got checks.
But
the other side's
not
there.
Notice right from the beginning we call it checks and balances. We didn't call it diffusion of opportunity to act or anything like that. We didn't call it scattering of initiatives. We call it checks. And then we throw in this euphemism, balance, as though checks will give us balance. We might have called it the system of checks and paralysis, as it has become.
Yeah. Dr. Charles Lindbloom today with us from Yale University. Once again, he's the Sterling Professor of Economics and Political Science Emeritus from Yale University. Among his books, as I mentioned, Inquiry and Change is the most recent. Behind that, we can look to such titles as Democracy and the Market System, published by Norwegian University Press in 1988, The Policymaking Process, a book by Prentice Hall in 1980, and Usable Knowledge. Usable Knowledge is subtitled Social Science and Social Problem Solving. It is a book written with David K. Cohen and published by Yale University Press in 1979. This is Conversations. If you, as a political economist and an observer, were to take a hand in opening up this gridlock that we perceive and you perceive stultifying the American political process now, what steps would you take to do it? Would you start with the veto powers? Where would you start?
Well, you know, yes, I would. I would try to cut down some of these veto powers. And there are various fronts on which one could move. But one that appeals to me, and I have never seen it yet discussed, and one ought to go by the rule that there aren't any a priori solutions that can be said to be the right one. One has to begin a discussion and get some ideas moving and challenging each other and try to design something. But where I would start with, I think, a proposal to reduce congressional staffs and congressional budgets for individual congressmen and senators, and take away their very substantial capacities to do things other than attend to business in a constructive way. First place, we give to each congressman a sufficient budget to employ a very large staff and open up the possibility that some of them take, which is to make a career out of doing favors for the constituents back home. They've got big enough staffs and budgets so they can set up incoming telephone lines and be in constant touch with constituents out there as I say, make a business out of doing favors at home and ingratiating themselves with the voters at home who think he's our friend and he's our man in Washington. Get himself reelected with almost no attention to any problems of public policy. That's an extreme case, but there are congressmen of that kind that are extremely delinquent in their legislative duties. We have to stop that. One way to stop it is to undercut the resources they put into it by taking the resources away from them, making favor doing just prohibitively expensive. They don't have the time, they don't have the staff. All right, that'll turn them then to a new interest in legislation, which is their proper interest anyway. Now there, what we want to do, it seems to me, is reduce the possibility that many congressmen exploit of taking positions and posturing on public issues with no particular possibility of doing anything constructive on them. He simply, you know, tries to get in the newspaper or on TV, is identified with a particular issue, and he hopes that'll help him get reelected. And whether he advances any solution, any problem, nobody knows, and he doesn't care as long as he's popularly identified. So we want to get him really seriously engaged. Now, we also want we know that you can't run a country if you've got, say, 500, 600 congressmen, each going his own way. They have got to coalesce. They've got to begin talking to each other and agree on general programs that will command the support of 100 or 200 or 300 or 400 congressmen. Take away their resources and their staff. The only way they can be effective at all is to join, to look for allies, to begin to interchange with potential allies in Congress so that coalitions can be formed that represent the important schools of thought on policy and clusters of votes sufficient to make a difference to the legislative outcome. The large staff, the large budgets we give them, all militate against that kind of constructive policy-making role for congressmen. So I think that would be a useful line of reform to explore. Also save us a lot of money for the congressional budgets.
And that argues from your point of view then that this anti-incumbency movement isn't really the issue. It's not throw the bums out and get a new crop. It's what you enable them to do once they're there.
Oh, yes, quite right. Yeah. That I don't mean to deprecate the anti-incumbency movement, though. Something is clearly wrong when we have this high rate of incumbency return to office. That's a symptom. But simply making the legislative contests a fairer contest so that you get more turnover won't be enough, it seems to be, by any means. We need something more to change the character of the whole congressional process. One could go as far, you know, as to suggest that we ought to try a British-style parliamentary cabinet system in which it explicitly reduces the parliament to a peripheral role in the legislative process and really puts the legislative process in the hands of a prime minister or a cabinet. That's a possible solution. I know many of my colleagues in the political science profession think that's the way American government ought to go. I am more wary than they are of that solution, and I think my proposal to undermine the capacity of congressmen each to go his own independent way would be a fruitful alternative line of reform to explore.
You've also said that the blocks within the committee and subcommittee system,
yes,
have to be ended. That is, my ability as the chair of a committee or,
yes,
subcommittee to decide what will be discussed. I can block anything I want if,
yes,
I'm powerful enough.
Yeah. Some advances have been made in recent times in that respect, but that's right. We have to try to shift the congressional committee from a authority to block to an authority to move ahead. You know, we don't usually think of our committees in Congress in this light, but it's an interesting light to think of them as. In the parliamentary system of, say, England, Britain, you have a cabinet, a small group of people who take particular responsibility to initiate policy. Now, just to stimulate our thinking about congressional reform, we might think of each one of these congressional committees as a little cabinet specialized to policymaking in a particular area in which it develops competence. Now, it's not the function of the British cabinet to block policy, it's the function of the British cabinet to make policy. Similarly, by careful enough redesign of congressional rules, it might be possible to design each of these little committees as a little specialized cabinet for a particular purpose, and in that way get some of the advantage of cabinet responsibility for initiation of change with the advantages of decentralization and specialization of competence by not thrusting all the policymaking responsibility on the same 10 or 20 or 30 cabinet members, mm-hmm. but thrusting it in this field on this group, and in this field on this group, and this field on this group, so that they all can be working on problems of manageable size on which they can develop specialized competence.
I want to ask a last question because we're running short of time. But that is that it seems to me that these proposals, along with perhaps a third proposal to limit the president's veto power, or at least rearrange it a bit, would create an uproar in Washington. The question is,
well, yes.
If you think this is a good proposal, do you think we can get there from here? And how?
Obviously, we are not on the point of taking seriously these proposals. What I said was we have to start a discussion. Mm-hmm. We have to get these things on somebody's desk to think about and worry about. The process of making profound changes in the constitutional structure of American government, that's a long, slow, drawn-out process, unless there's some kind of catastrophe that compels rapid adjustment to civil war or explosion of atomic bomb, but physical pestilence, disease, something, you know. There are always these remote possibilities that we'd be driven into a situation where overnight we restructure the government. But aside from those, we hope, remote possibilities and disasters, possibility of reform in the constitutional structure of American government is a pretty, at best, a very slow, pokey process.
I do want to take an opportunity to ask you just one more question. Are you optimistic about our ability as a political system to deal with the problems that are at hand? Get
no.
out of gridlock?
No.
No.
But then I don't know whether anybody is unambiguously optimistic or pessimistic. I find that along some lines of thought, I seem at war in my optimism with my pessimism along other certain lines of thought. I'm not a wholly integrated mind, and I suspect maybe very few of us are. When I think of the accomplishments of American democracy historically, the creation of the Constitution itself and its judicial amendment and its amendment through custom and tradition, there's a record there of pretty impressive growth of democratic competence and rationality, and so I think sometimes optimistically about the continuation of this process. Then I think back on other aspects of government and current aspects of American government. I think that the prospects of change are dismal. And I never wholly reconcile this optimistic and pessimistic streak in my thinking. So maybe my mind is an example of decentralized decision making.
Dr. Lindblom, thank you very much. We've been talking with Dr. Charles Lindblom, political scientist, economist from Yale University. Our thanks. I'm Susan McGinnis for Conversations. I hope you'll join us again next week.